accession number 18463, reel 20.
I'm inclined to think it was American, but lots of the lads believe that it was Chinese mortars. I really don't know. When we got down the bottom, we were the last down, everybody was loaded up, and they'd got three tanks waiting for us. And the Aussies up on the ridge they were on, they hadn't left yet, and they were doing the old white tails out on the bushes and smoky fires bit and walking about in the skyline bit to make out we weren't going. And just as we got down, they started to move down off the ridge. Presumably they had transport over there somewhere or other. We came out, we're at the end of the column on our three tanks, and six platoon loaded on it was a Patton, which was towing a Sherman recovery tank. And we all got on the Patton, and Jimmy came round and said, well, I think we'll probably have to fight to get down the bridge. So you'd better be wary. As it happened, we didn't. We started to go through Saul, and there were the most enormous barricades I've ever seen, made of rubble, straw bags filled with rubble, and they must have been 10 foot high, I should think, with gaps in them to let the vehicles go through. I mean, I would guess that was left over from the time when when the North Koreans had had it and they hadn't been cleared. Got down to the bridge, and there was an Argyle platoon guarding the bridge. We were going over different, we weren't actually going over the bridge that we'd been intending we should go over. We were going over the one, same one as 29 was going over. And we saw some of their vehicles again in the column. Slowly went over and got up the other side. The whole bridge is bobbing about a bit. And I heard later that there was some concern that the Centurions might sink the bridge as they went over because they were battle loaded. And we were a bit heavy because we got two of us, the Patton, plus the Sherman, and the old... it went down to sort of the water level, but as we moved across. But we got across, okay, up the other side. And then the column began to open out a bit. And we got flying through the day, pretty through the day, rather. It was I think we probably started earlier than I said, 12 o'clock. We probably started a bit earlier than that. We went on our way. And we got to Suwon, I think it was. And the Americans got a wonderful system when they're moving columns along. They have vehicles, lorries, loaded with fuel, and they come up and they drop four or five drums on the side of the road, go on, drop a few more, drop a few more. And as you go along, you just stop the side of this fuel, load up what you want, and off you go. And it might sound a bit wasteful, but it was certainly working quite well. And we stopped looking on a road which actually looked right down on Suwon, which is a very old city or town. And they started to get the fuel on. They pump it into put a pump in the thing, and pump it into the tank, and he loaded up with about two big drums full of it. I don't know how many gallons there is in a drum. And of course Nick, who's got his axe, said, we'll start a little fire, we'll cut it open and the fuel inside, we'll light it up, get a bit of heat. Hit it with his axe, and one of the tankers came running around and said, don't do that, don't do that. If you get a spark, the thing will explode and shower you with petrol and metal and goodness knows what else. So we gave that up. And shortly after that, we got back on the tank again, and she went across the northern side of Suwon, and then down the western side, and looking left into the town, there was a Sherman tank wedged in between an old medieval tower. I don't know whether he was stopped or what he was doing in there. Because we went off and then went west to east across. We're now going to a place called Ichon. A lot of people confuse that word Incheon, but in fact it's Ichon. We travelled on, and things were getting just a little bit difficult for the vehicles now. And engine covers are getting so hot that the studs on your boots are red hot. You can't find a spot to put your boot. These were different. The Shermans weren't like this, but the Pattons had these red hot engine covers. very, very difficult, and we're trying to work our way around the front of the turret, on the side of the turret, anywhere where your feet won't burn. And of course, that's burning the leather of your soles, your boots as well, of course, which is not a very good thing. And we dashed on through the night, and then the column stopped. And apparently, just ahead of us, a bulldozer was trying to get up a very, very slippery slope. And the tankers switched off their engines, and it was really quiet and a bit awesome, really. And the tank commander was saying to us, they should dump this darn thing, you know, in fairly graphic language, push it over the side and let the rest of us get on. But apparently the bulldozer driver was determined not to lose his bulldozer. He must have eventually got it up to the top. And I guess it stopped there probably about an hour, I guess. And during this time, the driver had got out, and young Nicky, who was falling asleep all over the place there, had let him get into into his seat. And he said to him, "It won't be warm for long. It'll be like an icebox for long. But you've got about, you know, a quarter of an hour before it gets cold." And I remember looking in. Nicky's in there asleep, and there was a little blue light over the driver's head there. And he sat outside with us, and we chatted away there about various things. And eventually the column began to move. Or the word came to, the Americans always say, wind them up, let them roll, that's our typical thing. And they got this wind them up bit. And they started the engines. And I thought to myself, well, I can't stand this heat. Because you've got 13 studs in each boot, and it's like 13 pins sticking in the sole of your boot. So I got off this tank and sat on the front of the Sherman. The recovery Sherman, which was being towed, and a bit of a mistake there because I wasn't really conversant with engines, I'm afraid. Anyway, we start up this hill, and it's absolute ice. The tracks are spinning and the engines flying, and unfortunately, the tank's on a solid bar. It's not on a tow rope; it's on a solid bar, and it just started to whip about all over the place like a whip. And I'm having to hang on for dear life because I think I'm going to get flung off. And I mean, no one would have stopped for me. They wouldn't have even known. Probably didn't even know I was there, except the section. Eventually get to the top, and we straighten out a bit. And we start down then on a sort of slope, forward slope. And she begins to whistle up a bit now and get a bit of speed up. And I didn't realise this, but the fumes from the tank ahead going straight into my face, and it was quite pleasant, really. It was quite warm. I hadn't realised the fumes would make me unconscious. And to cut a very long story short, I don't know how long they went or how long I was unconscious, but I woke up and it's all quiet. There isn't a sound. The tank of head's gone, as far as I can see. It's pitch black. And I gradually come round. And they've left me on the side of the road. They've dumped the tank and gone on. Nothing's coming behind or anything. Now, I'll be honest, I've panicked a little bit. I've got it down off and my head's all woozy. I went forward and I could see the back of the tank that they've been towing, my tank, is sticking up in the air. And there she is. She's swung round, gone over a slight bridge. I mean, it's only a tiny little bridge. And her gun's stuck in the river bed with the nose. She's buried right deep in the thing. And I could see all these bodies laid around the tank, all laid out, you know, they'd spread out. What had happened was the driver had lost control. She skidded on the ice, shot over the side, gun in, and all the lads were asleep, fortunately, they were asleep, and had been swung in an arc right down in this riverbed. And I could hear a few moans and groans and things like that. And I sort of got myself down there, found Bill Everett, who was the other section commander on this particular tank. And we started to go around and pull them up and what have you, get them all up on the road. The tank crew were all right, and they were sitting aside on their own, in a little group of their own. And they had an officer, but he chose not to join us in doing anything. We eventually got all the lads back up on the road, and we were very lucky. We only had two. Nicky had broken ribs, and another chap had something broken. I don't know quite what it was, but we got. I sent couple of chaps over into the village there to see if we could find a door, which we could carry Nick on, and because we obviously we got to start marching now. And they came back with a door, and they also came back with a chair. So we sit Nick in the chair, and up on the edge of the road. And the other chap said he wasn't too bad. He could hang on to himself, and he could walk. And all the others had just got bumps and bruises and things like that. So gradually started to get them, and I formed up. And I said to the tank commander, "Right, we're going to start marching. We're going to put a point out of a couple of guys, and then we'll have the main body with Nick on the door, and the injured guys, and we'll push along like that, and I'll hold up the rear and see what we could do." And funny enough, we had the rocket launcher again. We always seemed to end up with the rocket launcher team with us, or not a team, because we're no longer a team, it was just used by anybody. We had the rocket launcher anyway. And I start to get them all organised, and Nick's insisting he can walk, but he obviously couldn't. And we heard a tank coming up the rear. And we think now that we've been left behind, everybody's gone. And the thought was, this is a T-34 coming down here behind us, a bit sharp. So I popped the rocket launcher over the other side of the road. They got loaded up, ready to, you know, plonk him when he came around the corner. And I got the other lads laid out there as best I could. Nick can't lay down, so he's sitting with his rifle, sitting on the chair. He's going to do his bit from there. And the Americans are there in the ditch and waiting. And suddenly, around the corner, comes the platoon commander on the back of a Sherman or Patton, whatever it was. Patton, probably. And we thought, he's going to pick us up. He didn't. He went straight on by the way. He said, "There's a truck coming up behind." And I thought we still there. That's just what I said to those poor old black lads at Cunery. I said that. And they whistled by at full speed and showering us with dust. And a truck came up afterwards and picked us up. I should recap here a little bit. The Americans were not in the ditch there. They'd said they'd do point, and they'd moved off straight away. But that was a bit of a waste of time, because they'd vanished round the corner before the before we could even get moving. I mean, we couldn't get Nick on the door. He didn't want to get on, and he didn't want to be carried and all the rest of it. So they were well ahead. They weren't actually with us at this time when the tank rolled by. And presumably the tank, I imagine, picked them up. He would have picked up his own, but he wasn't going to pick us up. And anyway, we got on a lorry and went off down to a position that at just this moment... Could I stop for a second? Yes. And we went on, and we heard later that a lot of the trucks had pulled off into where Americans were still cooking up and things like that. Had a good meal, but we didn't. We went down well south, went through a place called Chang Hel Wan Ni, and then a good way south of that, where we stopped off, and we were put in beside a railway line. There was a great shed there, and we went into this shed, and there was a meal being cooked, central cooking, because most of the people were there ahead of us, and we were told we could have a meal. A lot of the chaps were so tired that they just laid down in there on the ground there and went to sleep. I did a little tour around, because we had obviously had sentries out, you know. And I did a little tour around. Funny enough, I found a brain gun barrel on the edge of the railway, thrown in the snow. I never could work out of that. I'd been there quite a long time, so obviously somebody had come up through there and dropped off a brain gun barrel at some time or other. We stayed there all that day, and I think it was probably the following morning we got the word that we were going forward again to west of Chang Hel Wan Ni. And in the meantime, we didn't move till about midday, and I wandered off and had a look around, and I looked in a house, and there was a family sitting around, a great big long table sitting around on the floor with the table laden with rice and food and this, that, and they insisted I go in. And I insisted I sat down with them, and I was very embarrassed, because I mean, we didn't have a lot of food, but we had quite sufficient for our needs. These poor people had very little at all. Anyway, they insisted. I sat down. The girls all giggled, and Mum and Dad all were looking after me. And well, Mother was anyway, Mama San as we called them. And she insisted I had a bowl of rice, with a big bowl of rice with a little porcelain spoon. And they wanted to have the other stuff as well, you know, the veg and stuff like that. But I couldn't force myself to. I would have eaten it. I would have liked to eat it, but it was theirs, and they hadn't got a lot, so I didn't eat that. So I did condescend to eat the rice, and eventually excused myself. And all the young girls of the family were all giggling and laughing. It was quite fun, really. And eventually, I thanked them very, very much, and came out and went off back full of me hot rice. And shortly after that, we loaded up on the trucks and moved forward to Chang Hai Wanli. And we got off there and started to march forward in the usual battle formation. And it was terribly difficult, because what had happened was the vehicles going over the road and the snow, it was just like walking on it was walking on ice. It wasn't like walking on ice, but rutted ice. And you really had to put your feet down very, very carefully. And we were going forward. We were just behind the company commander. I think four platoon probably up ahead, and company HQ, and then us. And suddenly, from the rear, a chap came flying by. He was one of the reinforcements. I know his name's on the tip of my tongue, but I can't remember. He was an ex-schoolmaster. Quite an unusual fella, actually. And he went flying by, and he had a great big brew can on the back, which was rattling about. We all have brew cans, of course, black and brew cans, but his was flying about. And he also got the stretcher, whistled by, came up to the company commander beside him and said, "Sir, permission to march out of the ordinary." And obviously the company commander hadn't got the faintest idea what he was talking about. So he did the best thing. He said, "Yes." And off flies this chap. Got about 200 yards ahead, collapsed on the ground with his stretcher and his brew can and all that, sat on the side of the road, and we all marched by. Company commander never even looked at him, wouldn't look at him. And he smiled sweetly up at Major Allen. We went on, and then he does again. And company commander's very, you know, he doesn't know what to think about this, before this chap's flying by every so often. Anyway, third time, he whistled by, got about 200 yards ahead, and just when he got 200 yards and collapsed on the ground, company commander called a halt. And we went off at a tangent and left him 200 yards ahead out there. I'm sure he did it deliberately, because we weren't on a path, and we had to wade through this, well, 4 or 5 feet of snow. It becomes like face powder, snow does in Korea. And you just literally like wading through face powder. And we went about, I guess, half a mile, three quarters of a mile, just going across the paddy over the paddy buns, and quite exhausting it was. And we eventually came to a little tiny village, and we were allocated one house, which we weren't allowed to use, incidentally, but buy a house, and we dug in around this house. Company HQ was behind us, and the other two platoons, I think, must have been up on the hills. I couldn't see them, in actual fact. And we dug in there for the night. And we had no bivouacs or anything like that. We just had ponchos. But Bill Everett had nipped into the house and nipped two doors. And we put these two doors together, put a poncho over the top, and we had a smashing little bivouac. And we were really very comfy. So once we'd finished our guard duties, we had a good night's sleep. And I was the first one to wake up in the morning. And it was full light, and there was something dripping on me through the top there. And I thought, crikey, it's full light. Pushed me way out, calling to Bill as well, and we pushed our way out, and there'd been a snowfall, about a foot of snow during the night. And the bright blue sky, sun was up, and there wasn't a sign of anybody. And Bill said, "They're bloody all gone." And I said, no, look, there was lumps. Everywhere you could see little lumps. The first thought was they were dead, you know. We went around kicking these lumps, and they weren't dead. During the course of the night, sometime during the night, and I'd be honest, I've got a jolly good idea of what time of the night. The NCO had not got up, or maybe got up and gone back to bed again, and we'd had no sentries on all night. We were absolutely, nobody had been there to do anything at all. And for some reason or other, the platoon commander and Ken Partridge, who was acting platoon sergeant, had stayed over with Company HQ, so they weren't with us. So we panicked a bit, got everybody up and out, kicked them and pulled them and shoved them, and then went over to where the trenches were, and of course they were full of snow. The LMG was under a bank of snow, and we'd also still got this wretched rocket launcher, and we dug them all out, and dug the snow out, and then ran about all over the place on the snow to put footprints about, because there was a certain amount of panic that if anybody found we were asleep all night without any sentries from about 2 o'clock when the snow came, we'd be in a certain amount of trouble. And looking over towards Company HQ, we couldn't see any sign of movement over there either. So I got a fair idea that they more or less were in the same boat. Anyway, we got away with it. And that platoon commander came over that night, and we were told that the following night, we could use the house for people off duty, which was good, because that meant we could start cooking in the kitchen and laid out on the floor and get the fire going and the old underfloor heating and what have you going. That would give a fair amount of protection, because this snow was at least a foot. It's come down overnight, covered the whole area, couldn't see anything, roads, the transport was stopped. I went over to Company HQ, and Ken was there, who was the acting platoon sergeant. I don't know why he stayed the night there and not with this section, but he had. But anyway, he was walking about with sunglasses on. I said, "What the devil have you got sunglasses on for?" He said, "I've got snow blindness. I'm being evacuated, so we've lost another one now." And sure enough, I didn't believe him at the time, but I'm sure it's true. He said he'd gone over to Company HQ and couldn't see, and he'd nearly fallen down the well, which sounds a bit of a story, but I'm sure it was true. He wouldn't have fibbed. Anyway, he was going to be evacuated. And as I say, we'd been given the house for the night, and we dug out all the pits, and apparently no one had noticed that we hadn't had any sentries out all night, from say about 2 o'clock when the snow started, about a period of, I suppose, about 3 hours, something like that. And we used the house then, got a good fire going, and we could get some brews and cook our food up in there, what have you. And that night we spent in the house. With the sentries and the posts out and what have you, everybody fairly confident that that'd never happen again. I knew who it was, but I didn't talk to him because I knew he was embarrassed, as I had been, not very long before. And we went through the night, and I guess about 1 o'clock, I woke up and I thought, by golly, I'm half hot. This underfloor heating's working a bit peculiar. And we'd got some special sleeping bags. We'd only just been issued with them at Christmas. We'd had one or two issues at Christmas, some balaclava helmets, and these white English super sleeping bags, white silky stuff it was. They weren't very good, but they were not too bad for a mattress. They didn't have a hood, or they weren't waterproof or anything like that, or semi-waterproof. And I was using mine for a mattress. And suddenly the damn thing caught fire. And within seconds, it was a blazing mass, and I ran out with it and stamped it out in the snow. And this darn thing, we should never have been issued to troops in the field, because it was a real hazard. I don't know whether I didn't smoke, but maybe somebody had thrown a cigarette end down, and maybe that's what caught it fire. It seems the most likely thing. I can't believe that it was sort of combustion from the underfloor heating. It seems unreasonable to think that. I think it was a cigarette end. Anyway, I have to spend the night, because all I've got now is me single blanket and me poncho, and it was a really cold night after that. Following day, we moved round the front of this hill into a village round the corner, which had a great big granite religious symbol of old years gone by, I guess it must have been 10 or 15 feet high, and we were given this little mound to dig in on. And unfortunately, of course, it was so hard. It took us virtually the rest of the day to dig in, and we just could not get down. I mean, it must have taken us 2 hours to get a foot down. And if we hadn't had an axe, we shared the axe around, and we cut through. Eventually, once you got through this about a foot, the ground underneath was down to about a meter, was solid, but you could undermine it from below, boring the pick in. We'd also got new picks, incidentally, and they were no use whatsoever. They'd been wrongly tempered. Very, very pointy they were, should have been good. But the point turned round and broke off, and you've got now a half inch square end, which is virtually useless. But we eventually got down to the normal, 4 foot 6 trenches down there through the solids. And I saw the platoon commander coming over and, to have a quick look around, make sure we were okay. And the company commander came with him. And I said to the platoon commander, "Is there any chance of us using one of the huts?" And he said, "I'll find out from the company commander, because one of the other platoons, they'd broken through the floor. They were in the houses. They'd broken through the floor and dug their trenches underneath. So they were shooting. They would have been shooting from underneath the houses. Whilst four platoon, that was five platoon, four platoon were up on the hill behind us. They had the worst place of all, with the wind blowing and the snow and what have you. Company headquarters naturally was in the village, as you expect." And he said, "I'll ask the company commander if he'll allow you to, but he said, I don't think he will, because it'll be a bit difficult getting there." Anyway, Major Allen came up, and he really set me up, really, quite honestly. He said to me, "Yes, it's a good position, Corporal. I'm pleased with that." And he said, "You'll be able to see the Chinese coming in over those fields without any trouble from here, won't you?" And I said, yes, I certainly will, sir." And he said, "I'm being sarcastic, Corporal. If they come in there," he said, "they'll be on you before you can say Jack Robinson, and you're asking to have half your section, half the platoon, in actual fact, in that house over there." And I said, "Well, yeah, I'll take your point. You're absolutely right. We'll just have to stick it out in the trenches." And he didn't say any more for a few minutes. He said, "Well, I'll tell you what," he said. "If you dig a," there was a wall, a mud wall behind us. I guess it was a meter thick at the bottom, 2 foot at the top, 6 foot high. He said, "If you cut a hole through that wall, I'll let you use the hut. And so, you'll just have your sentries up, your LMG posts up here, and you can use the house during the night." And we set to on this wall. It took us, it was stand to, and we'd only just got a little slot through. It was like concrete, absolutely solid concrete, and we got a little slot through. And I said to the platoon commander, "Well, we could squeeze through it." He said, "Well, make it a bit bigger, get it so you can squeeze through, and I'll let you use the house for the night." Because really, the cold now was the worst enemy of all. And we used the hut that night, and the next day we widened it out a little bit, and we got a good meter hole through here. And everybody was getting very cold, and the company commander had said that we either had to dig this pillar, this granite pillar, out and keep it down, or camouflage it with white sheets. Well, we hadn't got any white sheets, but we found some, funny enough, because we couldn't dig it out at all. I mean, I have no idea how deep it was. Probably went down 2 or 3 or 4 metres. But he was concerned, being a support company man, really, that it was a good target, and anybody out there would use that as an aiming post, literally, and drop anything straight on us. Anyway, we eventually, we couldn't get up. We hadn't got any means of getting up the top, so we got long poles and eventually hung some sheets over it, which we'd found in the houses, and we'd